Commissioners for the Tuesday, April 14th work session. It's a little echoey. Somebody has a hot mic on. I don't know what that means. So we're just working out a quick kink so that the audio will be comfortable for everyone.
I've just muted all.
Okay. So I see on camera Alan Rapplier, Stephen Rhodes, Stephen Roberts. Can all of you just wave so that I know you can hear me? Okay, terrific, great. And maybe there are other staff who've dialed into Zoom from their offices. So let's just dive right into the first item on the agenda, which is board and leadership communication. We do not have a business meeting today, so we won't need to discuss the formal agenda. Would anyone like to go first?
I can go first. This is Pam Trace. We have been working hard on our special business assistance program, and I just want to give a tremendous amount of thanks to Alex and to Aaron Doyle and to Chris Defebaugh and to John Southgate, Jerry. We've had so many meetings, and there's just been so many little things that we've tried to make sure run smoothly, and we're excited about this week. It's going to be, it's very big news, and it's just been well done. I'm sure there'll be a few kinks, but I have confidence that we can work through those things. On Wednesday night, I have the final meeting of the Get Moving 2020. And it's really more of a get together and celebrate the work that we've done, provide feedback. And so it's a closure meeting more than anything else. We do know that the Tier 2 programs were presented to council. They are still in discussion. So we are waiting. Obviously, we'll wait to see what the outcome is there. But the relationship between Washington County and the staff at Metro continues to be positive, and there's a lot of feedback back and forth about how we can best advocate for the needs for our county while recognizing the needs for all the other the rest of the region as well. So that's what's on my list.
Could I just ask a quick question on the business assistance program? Is the plan still to announce that sometime this week?
Yes.
Okay, terrific. Great. Thank you.
Is that an appropriate answer?
Sure, I have a couple of things. First, just as a reminder,
your mic's not on. I forgot to fill out my election form for that has to be done by April 15th, saying you're still a candidate. So don't forget to go on and do that if you haven't done that. Yeah. So anyway, don't forget.
What happens if you're late? Do they send you another email?
I don't know. There's probably some sort of a proposed penalty in there.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, it's pretty easy. But I'd forgotten to do that, so I got to log on and do that later today.
It's a pretty easy form. It doesn't take that long to fill it out. I mean, it shouldn't be anyway.
No. And I remember I just pulled mine out from when I was mayor, and I just replicate a lot of that stuff. Same thing. It's just asking where your sources of income are and all that stuff. So it's,
SEI,
pretty easy. The other thing is, last week my wife gathered together some of her friends, and they all baked cookies on Easter, and we delivered them to all the fire departments in the EOC yesterday. So they had about 60 dozen cookies.
Oh, wow.
That they all cooked, baked up, and delivered around. So that was That was fun. I did not go with her to deliver those, but it was quite a trek, I guess, and it was well-received, so. So that's all I got.
I don't have too much to report. I will be going to the I'll be going to the monthly Five Oaks Museum board meeting in a couple of days. Other than that, I don't really have too much to report.
Is that a live meeting?
I'm sorry?
Is that an in-person meeting?
No, it's, we're doing it Zoom, yeah.
Yesterday, we had a telephonic meeting for WCCC. Important thing, we had a number of presentations. Probably the important thing for this board, though, is the unanimous opinion of the mayors was to ask this board to defer this year's TDT increase 6 months so that they could look at it. And we've done that before. It's been a long time. I don't know, Dick, if you were on the board at the time, but we deferred when we had some economic issues once before. But it's been a long, long, long time. And it wasn't even TDT in those days. So it's something that they feel is important. There was a, you know, the chair was on the call as well, so she heard it. But it was some who said they didn't like to have us miss the percentage increase because it's hard to come back. Others understood that there was some difficulty, but we had a good number of people there. I think the only ones who were not there was Banks. Durham was there, but we couldn't quite pick him up on the screen. So anyway, there will be an ask of this board to do that.
What is the process? May I ask for the, what is the process for that ask? How does that officially come to us?
How it would happen is that the staff and Stephen.
Could we have Stephen Rhodes? Roberts, present this.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Stephen Roberts. I did send a memo just this morning, a little bit before the board meeting. I apologize. I thought I sent it late last night, but it was stuck in my outbox this morning when I logged in. So I submitted a memo that sort of recapped the WCCC conversation yesterday and their recommendation, which at this point, the motion was to consider suspending or delaying the pending rate increase for 6 months, just to provide some time to evaluate what the economic situation is related to COVID. And then if in 6 months it seems appropriate to move forward, that was their recommendation. And I want to clarify that the TDT ordinance, as I understand it, is a non-discretionary adjustment that the board needs to act on by May 1 each year and then takes effect on July 1 each year. We haven't had a chance to really discuss this in detail with County Council, but that's the way we understand it right now. However, we think that if the board were interested in pursuing a potential delay, I think if we deferred action on this item, which is currently scheduled for your action board meeting a week from today, we think that we could review some options with Alan and then determine if there's a potential path forward for us to consider some sort of a delay.
Actually, you know, Stephen, your presence on the screen reminded me. I just wanted to make you aware that this past week I did go out with a constituent who's been complaining about a crossing at Kemmer, the need for a pedestrian crossing on Kemmer Road near Mayberry Street. Near the Cooper Mountain Nature Park, and I have to say that having walked it, it's quite a bit more treacherous actually than I first thought. Just driving by, you're aware there's a sidewalk on one side and then a sidewalk on the other side of the street, and then the crossing has to be necessarily sort of at that point where sidewalk on the north side ends and where the sidewalk on the south side picks up on Cameron Road. But the immediate area right around that intersection, there's like a couple of ditches. It's actually pretty darn scary. So at some point, I promised him that I would circle back with staff and talk about this some more. Just so you're aware that I had been out there and had talked with his constituent about that pedestrian crossing.
So
okay, thank you. I've taken a note about that.
Thank you.
So back on the TDT, I'll take a look at your memo, certainly as one member of the commission. The voters did approve the transportation development tax in 2008 as a replacement for the prior traffic impact fee. And as I understand it, it is a rolling five-year average on construction costs. I'll see what information you've provided in your memo, but I have several questions about various conditions, because no matter what development that occurs during a rough patch has transportation impact fees just as much as a development that happens during a strong economic situation. And the voters approved the transportation development tax such that it accounts for 28% of the traffic impact for new development. So any collection we're not making just shifts the burden back to the other sources of transportation funding, including MSTIP. So I think we're all being asked to take a look at that memo, and if we have any questions, to direct them towards Mr. Roberts so we can consider future action, whether it's a delay or not. So, great. Anything else, Commissioner? Let's see. From my standpoint, there was a letter that had been distributed to us in support of TriMet asking for quiet zone support. I think, Mr. Rhodes, you had sent that to the commission so that we would do a thumbs up or not in this meeting. Is that correct? I think you're muted. I know.
Sorry. Yes, that's correct. And I heard back from Commissioner Rogers and Commissioner Scouten that they were fine with the letter.
Yeah, so when you send us something that says we'll be seeking direction at the meeting, we need to make sure that we're diligent about that. So for the rest of us, are we thumbs up on that letter? Okay, great.
Thank you.
It's been an incredibly, yesterday was incredibly hectic, but the amount of information that needs to be coordinated and communicated with regard to our COVID-19 time has continued fast and furiously. The governor has asked the Department of Corrections to come up with a plan for ensuring that if COVID is present in the two largest state prison and supervision facilities, that there are plans for that. And one theme had been to have an early release of prisoners, and with an examination of seven different categories of prisoners. This came up on our radar late Wednesday into Thursday. And Steve Berger has been participating in the advisory committee to the Department of Corrections and is doing a very able job. So there have been many different meetings and so forth to review the impact to communities. I've conferred with both the sheriff and the district attorney, and staff has continued to confer with them as well. Late Friday, the governor issued a statement that she is not proceeding with a mass release, which is a relief, but nonetheless, we still have to prepare for potential small releases. So work is continuing on that front. So just a heads up on that. We had an AOC legislative committee meeting yesterday, went through a lot of information about and concerns from each of the 8 districts about state and federal funding. Our staff had given me a heads up yesterday morning about a issue that they had with a proposal from AOC. So with their support, I came up to speed very quickly yesterday morning and have carried that forward with them. And as we all know, we had a series of documents we needed to read for either meetings yesterday or for today's meeting. So also on the AOC note, Mr. Rhodes, AOC will be sending a questionnaire looking for actual finance numbers for financial impacts that are outside our ordinary expenses, as well as revenue that we may be foregoing in these times of COVID. So when I receive that questionnaire, I'll be sure to forward it to you so that we can, our finance folks can take a look at that. I'm sure it's information that staff has been looking into already as part of the EOC. Phew. I think that's it for me. Yesterday was such a marathon. It's like, oh my gosh, is the week over yet? So sorry my energy is a little low this morning. Hopefully I'll boot up a little more as the meeting goes on. Leadership communication. Right, I have to get used to looking at the screen as opposed to looking around the table. Mr. Rhodes, do you want to go first?
Oh, I don't have anything today.
All righty. Mr. Rapplier?
Yes, we have the executive session a little bit later, and Chris Gilmore will be there in person, and I'll be phoning in for that. So that's it. Thank you.
Great. And we all received a memo in advance of that. Pam?
I have the follow-up memo. I'm trying to find the memo. I think it was March 27th or something like that. It's somewhere in my files, but in my computer, but I didn't immediately find it. So if Kathy, did you send that already to me, or to Anna? Maybe I'm trying to scramble here.
Worst case, I can bring it up on my screen.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I need to.
I just have a request. Previously, we had the projection of the Zoom attendees on this screen. Is it possible to do that again? It's hard for me to see from back here. Thank you.
Good idea.
Just one quick thing. Steve Rhodes, since we have 2 Steves, thank you for that memo to Charlie Sitton. That was well done. I had a request. Some of you may know Charlie from his basketball days at Oregon State, but he owns a couple of businesses in the city of Tualatin, and they're shut down, and was asking if there was any sort of deferral on property taxes or any sorts of relief the county could render. And I know our chair got involved a little bit on just the tail end of some of that conversation. And so Steve, you wrote a really nice response as to why that's not possible under state law, but I think it was very clear and succinct. And so I just wanted to say thank you for that.
I have no idea what response you're referring to, or even the issue.
Remember, I sent to you, and I said, if somebody hits the $10,000 from the hotelers, can they apply for other programs? That's how it all started. And
okay.
You misunderstood, sent it to Carolyn, and Carolyn said she didn't know what was going on. But that it all started with Charlie asking about, is there any aid that we would have? I'll put you back in the loop. I'm sorry, you're only getting pieces of it.
Okay.
Anyway, thanks, Steve, for the letter.
Sure, I was glad to do it. That was a difficult letter to write because I helped negotiate the deal that brought the hotel to Tualatin.
I didn't know that part.
We took care of legal, right? Okay, Diane.
Thank you. Clean Water Services is in stable emergency operations 24/7. The team had kind of a curveball thrown to them on Saturday evening. there were two almost simultaneous car accidents that took out the power grid in the Tiger Durham area. So one outage was in Metzger and one outage was out on Durham Road. And normally we have two separated power feeds, but because of the accidents, it created not only a blackout, but it did create a brownout situation, which causes some instability with the power source. So it took out our switchgear for about an hour. But the team scrambled. They did a great job. They prevented sanitary sewer overflows. They were able to get one leg of the switchgear back up and running again pretty quickly. So they did a good job. So it was exciting on Saturday. KATU had a feature on wipes and paper towels, you know, things that people are putting down the sewer. So we are having more responses to pump stations and our siphons. So the siphon is a gravity line that goes underneath a river. So it one side has a higher head that drives the sewage under the river. So we're having to respond to more of the siphons to keep them cleaned out. So people are trying to figure out what to do with their wipes, but we need them to throw it in the garbage is what we need them to do. We're gonna be working on a PSA with the chair to talk about it within the region to encourage people to not do that because—
Can the wipes.
Because a downside is they could plug up their pipes, which then could bring raw sewage into their homes. So we really need to be able to get people to can the wipes. The district continues to manage its needs for respiratory protection of the staff. So we have everything from fabric masks, and there's times when we need to use some of those procedural masks and N95s. So the team's been also looking at 3D printing of those shields for those N95 masks so we can make them go longer. And we have everything from respirators, but we're struggling to get some of the filtering material in for those full face masks. And we have ultimately self-contained breathing apparatus. The chair forwarded a concept of a personal forced air device, which we don't have currently in our equipment list, so the team's looking at that. But so we're trying to make sure we have full protection for the folks working in raw sewage. Other than that, the team is hopeful. They produced some good little videos, and they're feeling still very innovative and entrepreneurial to protect folks. Everything from hand sanitizer to wipes to face masks. So the team's really responding well.
Well, thank you again for the face mask as well as for the alcohol solution. I've been using that quite regularly. So, all right, I think we've gone around the table for leadership communication. So we're on to our next topic, the COVID-19 update. Welcome, Marnie. Marnie Kyle, our Director of Health and Human Services. You have taught us a lot about this virus and what's happening in the community, and it looks like you have a new button.
I do. My stepdaughter got this at Safeway, and it says we can get through this, and it's the Rosie the Riveter. I've enjoyed wearing it the last few days. Good morning, Chair Harrington and Board. Marnie Kyle, Director of Health and Human Services. So this morning I'm going to provide the numbers that I usually provide you. And then I want to tell you a short story, a little walk down memory lane. So the numbers for today, we have we had two new positives today. So I'm bringing that up because our numbers have gone from, you know, double-digit new positives to one-digit new positives. So that's a good thing. We have 366 cumulative positives in Washington County, 7 deaths, and 83 people that have been hospitalized. And remember, that's also a cumulative number. So most of those people get better and go out of the hospital. We are still dealing with long-term care center and adult foster care home outbreaks and clusters, and we still have a really important focus on that population, any congregate setting, really. So the team is working, they've built that team up, and they're working really closely with the state and with the long-term care centers, all of them, even if they don't have a current cluster. So with that, I want to share, hopefully it's a relatively quick story. So what I will say about this story is, one, I didn't get public information eyes on this. So if there's mistakes or problems, it's all mine. But I did base it on a great new communication tool that Wendy Gordon, who's been the lead county PIO since the beginning of this outbreak, and Mary, our new PIO, have put together really, and I wouldn't say it's a new communication strategy, but what they've done is really put together a document that describes what our communication strategy is. And so I'm using that kind of as a guide for telling this story, and then I'll send you this communication strategy when we're done this morning. And yesterday I sent the weekly communication report, so it's just a summary of the activity that we've done for the last week. So thank you to Wendy and the communication group. So there's three messages that I'm hoping I get across through this story. So one is, as you all know, we had the first case in Oregon. And so I want to talk about what does that mean to be first. And then the importance of incorporating an equity lens, which we've done since day one of this outbreak. And then I want to end with, well, what do we need to do to move into a new normal? So that's kind of my hope for this story. So on February 28th, we were notified that we had the first COVID positive case in Oregon. You guys probably remember, many of you were in DC with me, and you probably remember me running around and pulling you out of meetings or away from dinner, I think, for a couple of you that first time. Not only were we the first case in Oregon, but we had one of the first cases in the United States. It was just starting to trickle in. And I'm using the word reported first case because we know that there were cases before these reported cases. So what does that mean to be first? Remember, this is novel coronavirus. That means the CDC and we didn't know very much about this new coronavirus. We had all been following what was happening in China and Singapore and South Korea, but we were learning every day. What it meant to Washington County is that we had to develop everything from scratch. It's not like measles or salmonella or shigella, where we have standard interview tools, we have standard educational brochures, we have standard communication that we give to the public. We didn't have any of that. It meant that we had to develop new interview tools. We had to develop a plan for isolation and quarantine, patient, family, coworker, and public communication tools. None of that was developed. We had to start that. As more cases were reported, we moved into incident command, and on March 3rd, we opened the Emergency Operations Center. This was the first phase of the pandemic strategy and communication plan. And our strategy at that time, remember, was slow the disease. The public health strategies at this stage included identify new cases, interview all the new cases, isolate those cases, and quarantine contacts. From day one, we had to incorporate equity into our work. As a reminder, equity is much more than the languages we translate educational material to. In the beginning, equity meant protecting the individual cases because of the stigma and fear that was associated with the diagnosis. You may remember us reporting that that first case had been harassed and that somebody had actually added their name to a neighborhood watch list. We also needed to address the social and economic needs of those impacted, both the cases who were isolated and the contacts who were in quarantine. That meant that we needed to assure that they had access to food, rental assistance, and other supports that were needed. Equity also meant that as the number of cases grew, protecting not only those individuals, but the communities from stigmatism and racism. We had to emphasize anti-stigma messages at that time to protect communities. We didn't provide data unless it was useful to protect the public's health, And you may remember there were a lot of folks that weren't very happy about that. It also meant sharing information about signs and symptoms of infection, testing information, when to seek health care with many different communities in many different languages. We supported and relied on our trusted community partners to get this message out to these different communities. They have the relationships and they have the reach to help with our early messages. The next phase of the pandemic, the phase we're calling phase 1A, is slow the disease spread, gain knowledge, and educate the community. This is where we are now. Lots of community-wide prevention strategies through social distancing. By this time, most counties in Oregon had cases, and there was much more support at regional EOCs, emergency operations centers, the Oregon Health Authority, and many, 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 many state, federal, county, and city jurisdictions. And that meant we needed to coordinate and align our messages and our public health strategies. The main communication strategy was designed to persuade community members to stay home and save lives. In the meantime, the public health nurses, our health officer, and the others that were in our EOC continued to work 7 days a week to identify those cases early, interview all cases, and provide contacts, work sites, and information to the general public to help reduce the spread of the infection. Some of the equity concerns we're addressing at this point were around cultural norms and behaviors that related to families, holidays, and social separation. With the new recommendation around face masks, for example, there were concerns raised from people of color saying, I don't feel comfortable wearing a face mask. There's potential for biased reporting to local law enforcement. The other concern that we had beginning around this time frame is that we're soon going to be welcoming our migrant workforce. And we need to make sure that we have support for them and information during this pandemic. To address these concerns, we continue to monitor our data and identify the disparities. We're working with local law enforcement to reduce bias reporting, and we continue to deliver food, hygiene supplies, and work with the farm owners to ensure that the migrant camps can adhere to social distancing, both in their living quarters as well as in the fields, and that those workers will have access to health care and health information, as well as a place to isolate or quarantine if they need. And that's quite an undertaking. So now we can move to where are we heading? The next phase, what we're calling phase two, is relax physical distancing and prepare for the second wave. I want to remind us all, remember that the governor is the one that put the social distancing orders in place, and ultimately it's her decision about when to lift the orders. So right now, our messaging is physical distancing appears to be working. The most recent OHA prediction from April 10th, I don't even know what day it is anymore, from April 10th, was that the prevention methods may have prevented as many as 18,000 cases in Oregon. However, they are strongly urging us that we have to stay strong and maintain these strategies. As we enter this phase of recovery and begin a new normal, the public health strategy will need to continue, and we will also focus on supporting the community's mental, physical, and economic recovery. The final stage will be lifting the distance measures. The Oregon Health Authority report and several national studies have determined that in order to do this safely, we will need to work towards achieving herd immunity. Herd immunity means that at least 50% of our population is immune to COVID-19. And there's two ways to achieve that. The first way is enough people have to get sick, and that's not what we want. And that's part of this physical distancing, slowing the slowing the curve or flattening the curve so that it gives us time to develop a vaccination, because we want herd immunity to be achieved through highly immunized public. And that can take 1 to 2 years. So there's some tools that we need to have in place that most of our experts agree on, and there's a lot of others out there. So one is we need a fully resourced public health system that can manage case finding, interviews, and implement successful isolation and quarantine. That will not stop. It's not like we have a magic switch that the cases will just suddenly disappear. So we will need to continue to do case finding, interviews, and isolation and quarantine. Second, we need widely available COVID-19 testing. And in order for public health to identify those cases early, we need early, accurate, widely available testing. The other thing that we need is antibody testing so that we can better understand immunity post-infection. Until we have 50% herd immunity or higher, we can expect that we may ebb and flow through periods of loosening and tightening our physical distancing recommendations. So that's what I wanted to share with you. I know there's a lot of normal updates, and I'm happy to answer any questions, because there's some of the normal things that I didn't hit on, and I'm happy to answer questions if you have those, but you might be tired of that laundry list of other information.
I have a question. I maybe just to sort of reconfirm what I thought I heard at the start of your presentation, and thank you, Marnie.
Mm-hmm.
You said there are currently no clusters at any of the assisted living.
No, so to be really clear, we continue to monitor the both assisted living, long-term care facilities, and other adult foster care homes. Because of the way we define an outbreak, we need to have no new cases for at least 2 incubation periods. And so even the original long-term care facilities will be defined as outbreak for likely a month. But we still have several long-term care facility and adult foster care homes, yes.
There are these clusters, but you said, if I heard you correctly, that there have been no new outbreaks in any of these kinds of facilities.
We have 2 long-term care facilities, and those are not new. We have had an increase in adult foster home clusters. We're up to 5 that we're managing right now.
Okay.
I think the last number was 4, but that number has increased.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Treese?
Thank you, and thank you, Marnie, for your presentation. It's always interesting, and the perspective is important for us to remember where we were. And I might add again that was your birthday that you talked about as well.
It was only less than 50 days ago.
Yeah, that's right. Could you give us an update on what's happening at the hotel over by the fairgrounds?
Sure. Yes, so beginning actually yesterday, so the hotel at the fairgrounds is our homeless shelter respite center. So respite center, remember, is for people who are sick, but they're not sick enough to be in the hospital. So we originally opened, and we were only accepting people who had a COVID positive test that had been referred from a healthcare provider or the hospital or public health. And beginning yesterday, we took in our first person who has COVID symptoms and does not have a positive test yet. And I got a report from Mike Espy, who's managing the respite center, wonderful person. And he said, this is why we need to be here, and this is why we need to spend these resources. The person was really sick, and Mike and the staff felt really warmed that we had a place for this person to recover and wait for those test results, not in a car or in a campsite somewhere. So we are now accepting in the other wing people who have symptoms of COVID but may not have a positive test yet.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Rogers?
I don't know that I picked it up exactly. Everyone thinks that this COVID-19 is a death sentence, and it's not, obviously. There's only a very few who are dying. What were the numbers, again, that you cited for Washington County, people who have been diagnosed and are now healthy? I think I missed it.
So I didn't give the now healthy. So what we've...
You don't have them?
Yeah, what we have is 366 cumulative positive tests. And Tricia can correct me if I'm wrong, but what we've been seeing is roughly about 20% of people that are infected have pretty severe cases and end up in the hospital, and a smaller proportion of that in ICU or need of ventilators. And then we've had 7 people that have died. Roughly, yes. Yes, it's been roughly 1 to 2% that.
But I also saw in the news that the deaths in the United States have surpassed the typical or even the last year high of flu deaths as well. So
yes.
I remember.
And Ryan reminded me I owe you, Commissioner Rogers, the flu data. Sorry.
Because in your story of how far we've come since the first reported case in Oregon, which was here in Washington County, back in February, we were trying to raise awareness that please still get your flu shot because flu does kill people. And then this new novel coronavirus has overtaken that. Commissioner Treis.
Thank you, Chair. I have another question. I've been following the Oregon Health Authority data that comes out daily, and it's interesting to watch the dynamics change between Multnomah County and Washington County in terms of the numbers of deaths as well as the numbers of positive testing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. So we did report in our last situation report that we're no longer the highest number of new cases or deaths in the state, that Multnomah County has taken that position. I don't think that anybody can tell you exactly why. I think it has to do with we had the first detected case, and so we're probably a little bit ahead of them, but they have such a dense population and a larger population that you would expect over time that their numbers are going to outgrow our numbers.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for walking us through the story of what we've encountered, how the organization has tried to respond to the various needs that are as diverse as the community we serve. One of the aspects that I've been working on over the last week is thinking about moving from what has been labeled this shutdown phase, this stay home, save lives, to a phase of reopening. And one thought that I've had is we could end up with a controlled reopening where more of our facilities are able to reopen to customer use, but still with these protocols in place of physical distancing. So I'm hoping Mr. Rhodes somehow, you're still there. I'm hoping that you can work with our staff to think about things like how the library services could reopen across all of the city libraries in Washington County, and what kind of perhaps ticket management or other schemes could be used to help ensure that our residents across Washington County can once again return to using the library facilities, but can do so in a safe environment. I know as I have visited couple of different grocery stores. They're using altogether different methods. And as a person, I know that one made me feel a lot more comfortable in seeing the signage all over the store and many more people wearing fabric face coverings as opposed to not. So I look forward to us learning more about what we might do and what we might advocate for up through the governor's office. So I hope that you can think more about that and at least inform us about what might work well and what we can put our political weight behind.
Thank you.
Any other questions, commissioners? We've certainly come a long way. I know in the mayor's meeting yesterday that I was thinking that we had 4 weeks behind us of the Stay Home, Save Lives order. And sadly, I was wrong. And it's just 3 weeks. I know. I had totally drilled into my head that, yay, if we have 4 weeks, then we have 2 incubation periods behind us. From what we know now, is that third incubation period still as informative as we were hoping several weeks ago?
When I read the OHA update from April 10th, I thought just the 2 weeks of data that they had was really useful. We're getting close to having a full 4 weeks of data, which is going to be even more useful. The 3 incubation periods, I have to say that was my prediction. It's not necessary.
You're a public health expert compared to me.
I've been doing this a long time, and I just feel like that we'll have 3 incubation periods worth of data that will be much stronger. But the other considerations are how much can the health system capacity ensure that people would get the care that they need? So we have to look at that. We have to look at how available is testing. And so I think the data will tell us whether the social distancing is working and whether those trends continue to go flatten and to go down, which now they appear to be going down. But we have to watch that trajectory. And so my thought was at least 3 incubation periods. But I think we'll know when they look at the data again in a couple, well, maybe in a week, because that will have been 2 incubation periods.
Okay. The clearest message that I heard yesterday or saw yesterday was keep taking the extra precautions.
Yes.
We don't know if we're out of the woods yet regarding flattening the curve, but we know we're doing better.
And just for others, Chair Harrington, you and I have talked a little bit more. I want to be really clear that I am not predicting that in three incubation periods that we're going to flip a switch and go back to normal. That's not at all what I have been saying. What I've been saying is I think we'll have more data that will provide more guidance about when and how we can move towards a new normal. So I want to be really clear that I didn't predict, and not that you said that, but I just want to be clear for others that didn't hear the rest of that conversation.
Well, Marnie, I want to commend you and Dr. Bowman for helping us make data, science, public health informed decisions. Yeah. It's been really helpful.
Thank you.
That's where you're stressing data and from your standpoint, what feels like informed data to consider additional or changed steps is really helpful. Yeah.
Dr. Bauman and the team has been incredible. I'm just the one that shares the information, so thank you. I'll pass that along.
Commissioner?
Yeah, thank you. I here on the West Coast, we're doing better than almost anywhere else in the country in terms of being aggressive, fast, et cetera. But there's still states that are not doing any social distancing, at least officially. There's varying levels of effort. Any thoughts about how we could be reinfected by other parts of the country that have not taken this threat seriously, or as seriously as they should be, or have been too slow or late in responding?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's always a risk because we have open borders and a lot of movement to the United States. I mean, that has been significantly reduced. But I think that's one of the things, that's one of the reasons that we can't just flip a switch and say, okay, Oregon is safe now, even if we got down to really very low numbers. Because just like our first case, we don't know to this day where exactly it came from and what other cases were out in our communities before we recognized it. So that ability to do more widespread testing will help to protect us as we start loosening those restrictions.
Any other questions, commissioners? All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Onward ho we go together.
Thank you.
So we'll move on to our next item on the agenda, which I've now misplaced my agenda, is a legislative update. So we appear to have our government relations team here attending via our Zoom meeting, and we can see each of you on the screen. So just for the audio, we have Elizabeth Mazara-Myers, the interim government relations manager, Aaron Doyle, Jagjeet Nagra, and Paige Spence. Welcome. I'll turn it over to you.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Commissioners. This is Jagjeet Nagra, government relations manager for Washington County. Wanted to give you a bit of an update in terms of yesterday's release from the governor's office. It's a draft executive order. We have been patiently waiting for this document for quite some time now. We would have liked to see it last week, but we have it now, so better late than never. This executive order falls into government relations immediate relief category. As you recall, the way that we've set up our memo and a bit of our advocacy, which seems to be changing every day, is that we have buckets, three buckets: immediate relief, which is 1 day to 7 days, short-term relief, 8 days to 14 days, and long-term relief, basically looking out over the horizon, anything out over a month. So the two areas that this executive order focuses on squarely fit within our immediate relief buckets, which is great. And the first area corresponds to public meetings and quorum issues. And the second area corresponds to local budget meetings. So let me begin with the proposal around public meetings. So the county, Washington County, has been working diligently with our county council office and AOC basically to have relief around quorum requirements for the board if a board member is sick due to COVID. Additionally, it changes the meeting requirements for video-based meetings and telephonic meetings. So this gives a lot more flexibility. Additionally, if there are areas where a board member has to miss a meeting due to COVID or COVID-related responses, that the quorum is still held as long as that person is missing, essentially, for a COVID-related issue. So that gives us flexibility when it comes to public meetings and quorum rules. The next piece pertains to the local budget meetings. And what we are, one of the things that we were talking about at the outset was having some sort of a budget extension, a hard budget extension. And this executive order does not provide that, but it does provide us with the flexibility to continue expenditures even before the finalized budget, or if there's a delay related to COVID. So what it does is it gives us a little bit of flexibility without actually changing the date itself. Additionally, much like the public meetings requirements, this allows the local budget meetings to also move to telephonic and video-based settings. And if there's a requirement for somebody to actually give testimony in person, then that person can also give that testimony electronically as well. So it does give us the flexibility that we were looking for. So those are really the two big highlights that we have from the executive order. And we're hoping that early this week, that it's signed into law.
So with good that, morning, Chair and Commissioners. Any questions for Jagjeet before we move on?
I can.
Paige, hi. Can I just say something quickly?
Oh, sure.
I do want to say that there is a summary of the executive order in your memo, and that there is a press conference with the governor today at 11 a.m. We don't know the topic, but certainly we'll be updating you if it is about the executive order.
Okay. Well, let me just ask, though, just to make sure I understood the first part. Did you say, Jajit, that if for example, with the Board of Commissioners, if someone is absent because of COVID, that they don't count towards the quorum? I want to make sure I understood you correctly. That's what I heard.
Yes. That okay. is right.
Thank you.
And before I give up the mic here, I just want to circle back to an earlier comment that's not really directly related to this executive order. The chair had talked about AOC sending out a survey to various folks at the county to figure out budget impacts across the various departments. So I want to let you know that our assessment and taxation folks have received that survey, and they have sent it out to the various managers at the departmental level to basically do review of what those impacts would look like. I just wanted to make sure that we dotted our T's and crossed our I's in that point and weren't waiting for something that we actually are already working on and staffing.
But I want to make sure assessment and taxation is not our finance department.
That's correct, but it was sent to them because that was the only point of contact AOC had to give it to.
So I want to make sure it gets worked through the CAO's office and includes everything that it's supposed to. That's all.
Absolutely.
Chair Harrington, just wanted to let you know we have made that connection. So A&T and Finance will make sure and connect on that.
And make sure the EOC is all connected there. Thank you. It's back to you guys.
Okay, thanks. Good morning, Chair and Commissioners. For the audio, this is Paige Spence, your Government Relations Manager for HHS and Housing. Before I move on to what I wanna talk about, I did wanna mention while we're talking about the Governor, that there is an 11 a.m. press conference today. So we will be sure to provide information coming out of that press conference as well if there's anything substantive. What I wanted to mention is that on your board's behalf, Government Relations has been working with Van Spoyek, who again is our federal lobbying firm based in DC. They have been providing us guidance along the way and have been incredible partners with us. We are working on a letter that is in your packet that is quite lengthy. It's almost 4 pages long, but it is comprehensive and addressed to our federal delegation. So it will go to Senators Wyden and Merkley, as well as Congresswoman Bonamici. And it outlines both some funding relief and some regulatory relief that the county is seeking. Again, because it is quite lengthy, I am not going to go through it line by line, but just to let you know the areas that it does cover. Health and Human Services, some funding needs, of course, for public health and behavioral health, as in other crises in the past, we do see an uptick in mental health service needs. And of course, want our public health team to be well-resourced going into any potential second or even third wave. For housing, there is some clarity around how we can use our CDBG and our ESG funding. So we're asking for that clarity, as well as getting into some of the finances around rent arrears. So as of April 7th, our housing authority, and that was a key date because that was right after rent had really become due and the grace period and all that, the properties that our housing authority owns had only collected 64% of their normal rent. We do have some HUD funding to make up for that extra burden that the county is shouldering, but that money is going to run out soon. Around homelessness, funding for congregate shelter beds and nonprofit relief. For public safety, our sheriff's office has some infrastructure needs, rate relief for clean water services, and then several components under business assistance. And so GR is going to be working to finalize this letter, and we'll be sending it to the federal delegation, and we'll make sure that you all have a copy of that final version. Just wanted to let you know that it is almost finished and we'll be going to the delegation on your behalf.
Hey.
If there are no questions about that letter, which was lengthy, I will provide a quick update about state legislative work we are doing. I will also add on to that federal delegation letter, we will be looking for opportunities if there is a recovery package similar to what they did after the financial crisis in 2008, where there's an infrastructure package that's part of it. I know that's been part of the ongoing conversation. It's a little more long-term than short-term in that fourth relief package, more than likely. We've been working with LUT to be in contact with Vansquake to figure out how to get our priorities for filling of buckets of potential financing of county projects to get people back to work. And then we'll also coordinate with Clean Water Services to make sure that when the county speaks, it speaks with both the voice of the county's needs and Clean Water Services needs, even though we both have separate representation at the federal level, just to make sure we're coordinated, because infrastructure counts is more than just roads. It is all of the things that we take care of. But moving on to state legislative issues, some of you may have seen or heard that there is another legislative concept that is potentially available if there is a special session called related to COVID release. It's LC 29, and it is essentially a combination of all of the legislative concepts that we had seen previously. A couple weeks ago, we discussed them with you, that are providing a lot of different types of relief within a lot of different areas of response to COVID-19. That is a placeholder that the Speaker's office and the Senate President's office have put together of concepts that were created as a result of the COVID-19 interim committee's work and conversations with a variety of people. It also includes the response that's going, hopefully will be announced by the governor shortly in the executive order, but goes beyond that to create some flexibility in the land use timelines for local governments and other needs for other industries and sectors and responses that the state is handling, and hopefully providing more resources. But again, that's just a placeholder. We still don't know when a legislative session will occur. But to that end, we have been working with the chair and Marnie to provide consistent updates to our state legislative delegation through weekly calls. We will use those platforms to talk about the needs of the county and what our response has been, and where we have fallen short because the resources aren't being provided, and where we would like to see that investment from the state go to be really truly responsive to how we've been reacting on the ground. Our legislative delegation has been really appreciative, gotten a lot of positive feedback, and they just consistently want to know what we need. So that way, when a legislative session does come more fully to the fore as the next step for them, they have their list of needs for the county in hand. We've been focusing a lot on our response related to homelessness and getting shelters up and running. Marnie's been doing a great job providing all that information about all the details that they want. A lot of conversation also around the PPE needs and making sure that the county is well stocked. And moving forward, we'll be also continuing that conversation about when we enter into the recovery process. Our legislators want to know how our systems will ramp back up, particularly now they're thinking about things like our courts. And how our already understaffed court bench is going to take on all of the cases that have essentially been put on hold. Similarly, making sure that community corrections is at the forefront of our delegation's minds, given the shortfall in the budget there. But again, so much of this is going to rest on the revenue conversations, but we need to have our list prepared, and that's what we're doing through these calls and through our ongoing conversations. Other than that, I don't have any late breaking news about anything new or fun. We look forward to answering any other questions or concerns that you might have about any of the things that we've brought up to you at this time.
I know it's hard for you, just seeing this very large screen of us in the auditorium, to get any feedback. I have found with masks, that cuts off most of the facial expressions, and your view shed is much different than if you were sitting at the table right in front of us. So I'm just holding up my hand to help you out a little bit. I want to commend the team for the memo that you provided us last Tuesday on the end of session wrap-up, and it relates to what Aaron was just talking about in terms of the, what's the phrase, Elizabeth, the catastrophic emergency session?
It's the catastrophic disaster session.
Catastrophic disaster session. Okay.
We can just call it the COVID-19 relief session, I think.
Well, as it relates to what our priorities are, certainly there are the COVID-specific items and dealing with the costs and the economic impacts. But the priorities, the five priorities that we had from the short legislative session remain, don't they? They're still pertinent. And you did a really good job with this end of session wrap-up memo. So I wanted to make note of that. I know you provided that to us as a handout in the meeting last week. And so I wanted to bring it back to the board to see if any commissioners had any questions on that or additional comments.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I don't know if you would have, any of you would have anything beyond what I read in the press releases, but if you, any thoughts, comments, et cetera, about the sort of this emerging three Pacific Coast states working in coordination in some kind of a compact, any sort of other information outside of the four corners of the press release?
No.
No, okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Skelton, if that is addressed during the press conference, we'll make sure that we send notes out about it.
Are there any other, is there any other information that the GR team wanted to share with the board at this time that we haven't covered? Are there any other questions or comments from
just the board? One piece, Chair. So one thing I wanted to underscore is that, you know, Aaron touched on this and Chair, you've talked about it a few times, is that our priorities from short session still remain. When I'm engaging in advocacy with our legislators, and this is something I would implore the board to do as well, to use their political capital, is to remind the legislators of the hole that was left from the short session. And the needs ramping up vis-a-vis COVID are only exacerbating those underlying shortfalls. And so, you know, one thing I learned from my experience in congressional service is that opportunities and crises is when we have the opportunity to move the dial for our benefit or for the benefit of the community, truly. And I think that when you're on the phone with legislators or you're doing video conferences, please remind them of that and don't be bashful of it, because it's important. And there's a lot expected of our frontline staff when it comes to HHS or public safety or even taxation assessment. You know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done and things have ramped up and work has become more difficult. And so we should use this opportunity as a reminder to underscore the needs that were left hanging from the 2020 short session. I just want to underscore that point because, you know, those haven't just evaporated.
One quick comment. As you know, we took a haircut at WSI of about $3 million in the last budget session, and with probably the most vulnerable population in the state of Oregon, I would hope as we start to look at this comeback, whenever that happens, that there will be some back funding. And I know there's several people that I'm looking at faces who've been very good about pressing that issue in the governor's office, but we need to not forget that. This is going to be very, very painful if we don't get some job training. That's my serious comment, my less than serious comment. You have a new look there with the hat. What is that exactly?
I have not been able to access a barber. And with a balding head, I get this very funny clown fro. And I thought that for everybody's benefit, I wouldn't offend their aesthetic or, you know, visuals, and you know, so I just thought this would be the best way to do it. I was hoping you'd focus on my tie, but rather you focused on my headgear.
Well, you look good.
I want to know if you're really wearing sweatpants along with your coat and tie.
Yeah, nothing. Just sweatpants.
That I will not be sharing on this call.
If I may interrupt, related to the Work Systems Inc. And workforce development dollars, yes, that remains one of our five priorities. We are also working with Work Systems Inc. through this process to see how we can better partner with them as they are expanding their repertoire of work that they can do on behalf of businesses in Washington County through the economic development response work. We are also supportive of them as a job retraining center, because when we turn into a recovery process where we are looking at things like potential infrastructure packages and returning to work, we need to make sure that those that have actually lost their jobs permanently have the skills they need to get back into a workforce, that it will probably be significantly different than it was, at least for the short-term future, as opposed to the long-term future, as opposed to the present.
Okay, we'll move on to our next agenda item then. Thank you very much, Government Relations team, and job well done in terms of our first total Zoom topic. Thank you. Next, we'll move on to the County Budget Committee recruitment with our Interim Director of Support Services and our County CFO, Jack Liang.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Harrington. Good morning, Commissioners. And I am, for the record, my name is Jack Liang, and I am in front of you to discuss about the Budget Committee member recruitment process. Now, this item was presented to you at last week's work session, and my apologies, we had some data errors in the matrix of the candidates, and we have since corrected these errors and provided new copies of this matrix, as well as the candidates' applicants. We included some recommendations in the matrix, but I just want to reiterate that it is definitely your board's authority to pick from the applicants and then make appointment selections with this. So just to reiterate what we covered last week is for the county's main committee, we have two vacancies, and we have 15 applicants in total. And what we recommended is Leroy Bentley, who is an existing member, past chair, and Karen Boland, who has been serving on a different committee within the county, but this is definitely her new application for this main budget committee. And for the ESPD and URMD, that's...
Before yes. We move on, is everyone clear on that recommendation and the time frame? Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. And for ESPD and URMD, that's the committee that we had four vacancies in total this year. This is a committee that we still are in the process of staggering the terms of the applicants. And we did struggle a little bit with the number of applicants. So we ended up with eight in total. And the recommendation is to appoint a reapplying member, Anthony Mills, for a shorter term, which will terms at the end of 21 instead of 22, and the other three members who are all new to this committee to have a term ending in June of 2022. And we will need one more kind of staggering term of effort next year when it comes up, just to get to a full three-year staggering term for this budget committee. And then we won't run into a four vacancy in 1 year kind of situation again. And for the North Bethany County Service District for Road Budget Committee, we have one vacancy and four applicants in total. And the recommendation is to appoint Bruce Young for this committee. And we will achieve a full staggering term of 3 years with all five lay members for this budget committee for this one. So with that, that's all the information I have prepared today. I'm ready to answer any of your questions.
I don't have a question, just a comment. There are a lot of applicants for each of these slots. It's definitely a challenge. There are any number of folks, and I can think of someone I've worked with quite a bit in the past who
yes.
is good with budgets, Jim McCrae at City of Beaverton. But we just really have a wealth of choices, and it's hard to say you can't serve on this committee, but there we are.
Yes.
We have an embarrassment of riches, which is a better problem than having lack of applicants, obviously.
Yes, that's a very very great comment, and this is definitely one committee, especially for the main Washington County Budget Committee. We do have a long list of applicants that has been essentially in the list for quite a while, and then we, you know, we really only have five seats that comes up with the occasional vacancies. But with the staggering of term, we should have vacancies coming up every year now, going into the future. So we should be able to get new applicants into the community work in here. So, but you're absolutely right. This is the one committee that we do have to let folks know that. Thank you for your interest. Unfortunately, we don't have as many seats as the applicants. So.
Mr. Treese?
I was just going to comment that, like Commissioner Skouten, we have a great number of applicants. I want to make sure that we know why we do and that we continue in that vein. So I think that there are several reasons why, but I want to make sure that we continue to make sure that we have a strong list that we can work from. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, seeing no other questions or comments, I think we're all set.
Okay. Well, we will prepare an agenda for next week's board meeting, and then you will see the agenda to appoint budget committee members. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. All right. For the remainder of our work session today, we have two different executive sessions. And before we proceed to executive sessions, we're going to take a break for 15 minutes. Are there any last commissioner comments before we break?
This is an IT question and comment. I had a meeting that was scheduled with county people. It was supposed to be the Microsoft Teams meeting. And I don't know if any of you have tried to use Teams externally. It worked for me when I was in the office with my Surface, but the system didn't recognize my microphone. So I don't know if others are having problems when we are away from the county, but I wanted to make sure that I'm dealing with my issue and to raise the issue so that if you are looking at using Teams outside, make sure that your system works. We ended up having to go to a Zoom meeting.
I'll be around after the executive session to close up so I can help you guys then.
Great, thank you.
Any other commissioner comments? All right, so we'll take a break and then we'll convene in executive session after the...
Could I have just a moment?
We don't take public comment during our work session.
It's not, it's something to address the board with over an article that was printed about a month ago, and I was going to talk to Commissioner Willie, but I think he was on vacation.
I'm sorry, sir, we do not take public comment during work session. All right, so it's now 10 of 10, so we'll break and come back at 5 past 10 in 15 minutes. Thank you. And when we convene in executive session, it will only be through conference call, so our CAO and our county council will need to dial into a conference call. We don't do executive sessions over Zoom.